This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Police officials revealed this week that Raleigh officers spied on Moral Monday protesters at the General Assembly. Plainclothes police officers went to meetings where Moral Monday protesters planned upcoming rallies. The police say the efforts were necessary for public safety. The news has raised some legal questions in the minds of NAACP attorneys. And Associated Press reporter Michael Biesecker is still with us. He covered this story as well. Michael, tell us how this came to light.
Well, last Friday was the first trial of a Moral Monday protester arrested at the legislature, which there were about 940 people arrested during the last session. And at that trial, one of the primary witnesses was General Assembly Police Chief Jeff Weaver. And as part of his testimony, he disclosed that he had been receiving advance intelligence reports about what to expect with the protest. And he cited things about those reports that concerned him. He felt that there might be anarchists in the crowd. There might be the opportunity or chance of violence at the General Assembly. And he basically used those intelligence reports to prepare his procedures for dealing with the protesters. That raised the question in my mind. I was in the courtroom of, well, who provided these reports? He said on the stand they were provided by another law enforcement agency. I asked him during a break who provided him the reports. He refused to say. So in the subsequent rest of the day and on Monday, I went to every state law enforcement agency and asked their spokesman, did y'all send plainclothes officers to monitor or surveil the NAACP meetings? And to every agency said no. I went to the Raleigh police and asked the same question. And the response I got back in writing after a few hours was that while we often conduct surveillance of this type to protect public safety, whether we did in this specific instance is not a public record. So that obviously raised the question about, was it Raleigh? And I went to city council members, including Marianne Baldwin, who's the chair of the council's Law and Public Safety Committee. She started asking questions and came back to me that a city official from the city manager's office had told her, yes, indeed, there were plainclothes Raleigh officers at some of these NAACP planning meetings. That forced, within hours, the Raleigh police chief to come out and basically issue a statement confirming that officers had been there.
So first of all, thank you for your alertness and noticing that there was something else behind that once you heard the testimony and your perseverance. Let me thank you on behalf of all of us here who care about openness in government. Now, so the question is, well, so what? I mean, and you found this out and police went to a meeting and this is their due diligence. They're trying to protect the public, and showing up at a meeting in plain clothes and not identifying yourself is one way to do that.
Well, and they make the point that these were meetings that were open to the public. And certainly these were meetings that the NAACP had announced in advance, sort of a pregame for the Moral Monday protest that evening. The press was invited, and there was a very public portion that was almost like a media conference that would take place usually in the sanctuary of a church. Now, after that, members of the media and other visitors would be asked to leave so that the protesters could remain behind and do detailed planning and confer with their attorneys. And so the question now raised by Reverend Barber, the president of the state chapter of the NAACP, is if police officers were present and unannounced for those portions of the meeting, hearing the information provided to the protesters from their attorneys about what to expect and answer any questions they had, would that be subject to attorney-client privilege? And did the police and later prosecutors receive intelligence reports about what happened inside of those meetings where their legal strategy was discussed? And at the trial on Friday, the prosecutor handling the case did ask the defendant a series of questions that suggested she had at least some knowledge of that portion of the meeting, asked if he had signed a waiver provided by the NAACP saying he knew he might be arrested, asked if he had volunteered to be arrested. And so that raises questions, too, about whether the Wake County District Attorney's Office received those same reports. NAACP attorneys and the attorneys volunteering to defend the Moral Monday protesters say one of their priorities will be through the discovery process once these cases are appealed to superior courts, seeking those intelligence reports.
And what have you found? What are Raleigh police saying about whether they were present for that part of the meeting?
The police chief, Cassandra Deck Brown, said specifically that they were not there for those non-public portions. I take her at her word until someone proves otherwise.
All right. Well, this does raise other questions and certainly reminds us of other times in which police and police law enforcement agencies have been surveilling Americans, sometimes legally, sometimes not. And I want to bring a couple more guests into this discussion. Liz Seymour is with us. She is Executive Director of the Interactive Resource Center in Greensboro. Welcome, Liz.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Carla Holloway, a professor of law, women's studies, and English at Duke University. Carla, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So when you hear this, I mean, there is a history of police spying on protesters and activists. It goes back a long way.
Oh, a long ways. We can just start with the beginning of the 20th century. The event I like to mark is Marcus Garvey's protests in New York City, and also marked the beginning of J. Edgar Hoover's service in the what became the Federal Bureau of Investigation as a very young officer. And in the Federal Bureau, Hoover developed reports on Garvey's activities, hoping to find something that would enable him to prosecute, break a law and prosecute him eventually. So you're right, this has a long history. It was refined and honed, especially during the Civil Rights Movement, when organizations from SCLC, Reverend King's organization, to SNCC, which began here in Raleigh, civil rights protests were routinely surveilled. The Black Panthers, of course, and the methods changed with the as the technologies of the century advanced. But certainly the history of surveillance is old and well practiced. And my concerns now are getting even more refined. What kind of information is collected? Where is it kept? What are the records? Does it include DNA?
Yeah. Well, and Liz, you know, it's interesting because the term anarchist came up in this, a concern that there might be anarchists in the group, therefore justifying the surveillance. You were a card carrier. Do anarchists carry cards, by the way? I guess
no,
not.
No, we make our own cards.
And then rip them up, because who wants to be part of that club? Forgive me, I'm being facetious, but you were an anarchist, a self-described anarchist.
And still am, and I think more people are than realize, which makes it all the more ridiculous that the word anarchist is used. It's sort of like all reason shuts down when you use the word anarchist, and that therefore organizations and police departments can justify surveillance because the word anarchist sounds so scary. They're really, if you push them to say, well, what exactly are you afraid of? It would be difficult to say what violence, what insurrection people are expecting. But if you justify what you're doing by saying, well, you know, we wouldn't normally do this, but there might have been anarchists in the crowd, everybody has been kind of trained to say, oh, I got you. Okay.
Yeah, let's be careful of them. Michael Biesegard, of course, there's really no legal justification. I mean, the police don't have a particular authority to surveil anarchists other than another group.
Everyone has the same First Amendment rights, as far as I know.
And you know something about the particular group they were talking about, and so maybe you can tell us the particulars of this group that was of interest to the police. One of the groups, anyway.
Yeah, one of the groups that the police chief specifically mentioned on the witness stand is called Raleigh Fist. You know, they have a web page. It has a sort of a manifesto on it about what they believe. They don't assign themselves any sort of label. Reading what their beliefs are, I might classify them as more socialist than anarchist, but I don't know if the chief was making those sorts of distinctions.
Well, I think socialism is still legal in this country
as
well.
But the question it does raise is the chief said he was specifically concerned that there were anti-government protesters in this group. And certainly in 2010, there were mass protests at the legislature while he was chief there by the Tea Party and other groups that advertised the fact they're anti-government. So you have to question whether those groups were subject to the same level of surveillance. Certainly there weren't the mass arrests that there were last summer. Those are questions we don't have the answer to.
Well, and here the other thing that the police were saying was that the protesters were chanting in a way that suggested there might be violence. Tell us about that chant that alerted them to this.
He specifically cited a chant, fight, 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 that concerned him. Now, you ask the members of the NAACP who organized the protest what that chant was about, and they say, have you seen the movie Red Tails about the Tuskegee Airmen, and that they would chant, fight, fight, fight. Now, they weren't just talking about fighting Nazis. They were also talking about fighting for equal rights, fighting for the ability to fight for their country on equal terms. And so the mantle of that fight in a civil rights context doesn't have anything to do with violence. And certainly the NAACP is a nonviolent group. And at the Moral Monday events I was at, Reverend Barber was very clear and telling the crowd to respect the police for doing their job, that they should not resist, and that they should not be violent in any way.
So context is everything. I want to hear a clip from that film, Red Tails. Pilots are chanting, "We fight." Let's listen to the clip.
Nothing's difficult.
Everything's a challenge.
Through adversity to the stars.
From the last plane to the last bullet to the last minute to the last man, we fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
So there we go. We fight, we fight, we fight. It's belligerent. It's a call to action. On the other hand, it depends on the context. And the question is, when we activate the police, when do we bring law enforcement and activate them when we hear something that's a potential threat? Because there are other times when people speak from a very high pulpit against the government, and we would never think of enacting the police. For instance, Ronald Reagan at his inaugural.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Well, why aren't we watching that guy?
See, this is why we can't depend on a common usage and a common perception of a word like anarchy or a word like fight. The whole notion of stigmatizing because a reasonable person standard would likely be used. But, well, what do you think an anarchist is? And although I agree that this is no label that should inspire fear or police, the whole notion of anarchy suggesting that it might chill speech is very important in terms of a protest organized by the NAACP and depending on people feeling secure enough to express their First Amendment speech. So the argument, the response of the NAACP, I think, is exactly right to be deeply concerned about this. The exchange of information between lawyers and their potential clients is certainly critical. And what kind of discovery is shared between the two sides in a courtroom? And what will that, what does the language of anarchy mean for a policeman going into the event looking for people who might look like an anarchist? The last time I don't know that I could see one if I tried to find one. But it would also characterize how a police might respond to a situation if they had a prior conviction that there would be disruptive people in the audience rather than just information gathering as was shared in the first scenario. But as they thought more about what they were saying and tried to clarify things, we have to be very concerned about what this perception of conduct might have meant for the rights of individual protesters.
Liz Seymour?
Well, I agree with everything, and that it's kind of the thin end of the wedge. To use words that have become scare tactic words, right, as a way to justify, because you can't say we sent the police in to do surveillance on black ministers or nuns or people who came in a bus from their church from another part of the state. But if you say, well, but we were looking for anarchists, then suddenly a lot of other people are vulnerable to being under surveillance, too. So it's a word that gets thrown around without a whole lot of justification, and it doesn't. And on top of that, anarchists are not anybody to be afraid of. But as long as the perception is there, it actually opens the door for fear and then permission for things that we wouldn't otherwise permit.
Liz, I wonder what your experiences were with people who knew you first and then found out that you were an anarchist, and the other way around, when you were introduced as an anarchist, sort of how those perceptions changed or how you felt the reception that you were getting.
Well, because I think more people are anarchists than realize, when I often explain to people my beliefs, and everybody nods, and then I say, you know, those are the beliefs that are historically considered anarchist, and then people look really surprised. I've actually had a little bit of experience with surveillance because when 2 years ago when the Occupy movement was active around the country and in Greensboro, and there was an encampment set up here, I have on secondhand authority, but good authority, that my picture and description was on the second page of a notebook that was issued to all the police downtown as somebody to look out for. And all I can think is I must be living in the safest city in the country if I am the second most dangerous person in this city.
Well, and you should probably tell us what Interactive Resource Center is in Greensboro to find out just how dangerous you are. What is it that you started there in Greensboro?
We are a day resource center for people who are homeless or trying to keep from becoming homeless, and see about 200 people a day, and are helping people find jobs and a place to sleep and get medical care and that kind of thing, but done in a very horizontal, grassroots kind of way. So I was able to bring some of my beliefs and practices into this kind of work.
Now, to be fair, the police have surveilled right-wing groups as well. The FBI has infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan and Nazis, although interestingly, when they did that and had informants in Nazi and Klan organizations in Greensboro in the 70s and had information about a rally and their presence at a Kill the Klan rally, they seem to use that information to absent themselves from the potential violence.
Right. The history has included a history when informants that we learn about later did not interfere with violence that resulted from protests and demonstrations. And this is how it's very complicated to think about what your individual act might be once you are designated a person who is going to surveil, and whether or not the public can depend on that being consistent enough and applied across the board enough to feel safe with that kind of surveillance or to feel threatened by it, which is what has happened in the history in Raleigh, certainly in the history of the civil rights movement. There were people who surveilled the Klan and did nothing about lynchings. So what we get to depend on as a population comes very close to how well we can trust our law enforcement to actually be those who protect rather than those who come in with a prior assumption of fear and suspicion of the public.
And what it also allows, I think, in public, in what we permit socially, again, going back to name calling, if I call you a Black Panther and I associate you with violence, then if the police raid your apartment in the middle of the night and you're Fred Hampton and I come in with guns blazing, you can assume that you're going to be shot back at, and then you kill him in his room. And the public says, well, you know, these are violent people. Mm-hmm. And so therefore that action, which is clearly designed to cause a gunfight and kill a man nearly in his sleep, is permissible because of the term Black Panther that had become associated with right. A threatening kind of violence.
Right. And this is why I think it's so important to understand and to interrogate our presumptions around labels of people. You're absolutely right about the assassination of Panthers and Fred Hampton during that time, during the civil rights and past that era. But the assignation of anarchist or not, we have to be very concerned about, because it will allow a kind of permissibility around action that we later use to justify something that we had not anticipated, or that we can plan a particular course of action against people whom we have selected out as being those who we don't agree with politically.
And I guess, go ahead, Liz.
Oh, I was going to say, we saw exactly the same thing in the 50s with the Red Scare, and that
right.
led to McCarthyism. And there's certainly a kernel of truth in everything. There were people whose views were different from the prevailing view, but that is very far different from saying that we are so in danger that we need to give up our liberties in order to protect ourselves.
And we are completely out of time, so we have not enough to talk about what that word terrorist permits us to do here and abroad. But we don't have time for that, so I will thank all of you. Liz Seymour, Executive Director of Interactive Resource Center in Greensboro, Carla Holloway, a professor of law, women's studies, and English at Duke, and Michael Biesecker, an Associated Press reporter. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Coming up, the music of Schooner, live on the State of Things. Stay with us.